You're listening to the Charlottesville Podcasting Network with your host, Dan Gould. On Thursday, September 20th, 2012, Bruce Carveth presented the third lecture in our series entitled Virginia History 301, The Old Dominion in Antebellum Times. Carveth tells the story of Edward Coles, an Albemarle County native who, on April 14, 1819, freed his slaves. The freeing of slaves by one's will was rare. Freeing of slaves while their master still lived was almost unheard of, according to Carveth. Listen as he recounts the amazing events of Coles' life. Bruce Carveth is a writer, editor, database developer, and independent scholar currently living in Charlottesville, Virginia. Born and raised in Toronto, Ontario, Mr. Carveth moved to Central Virginia in 1983. He discovered the little-known story of Edward Coles in 1998, then joined forces with his writing partner Kurt Likely to publish Crusade Against Slavery, Edward Coles, Pioneer of Freedom, in 2011. Mr. Carveth has an M.A. in Applied Social and Community Psychology from the University of Guelph in Ontario and a master's degree in Urban and Regional Planning from Virginia Tech. The series was organized by award-winning historian and Charlottesville-based author, lecturer, and cartographer Rick Britton in conjunction with the Senior Center in Charlottesville. This is the third of a four-part Thursday series. Here's Bruce Carveth.
Thank you, Rick. What a nice introduction. I did bring a few copies of this book with me. If we run out, I also have a sign-up sheet. And before I go on, let me tell you there is one error on this yellow sheet. The prices at the bottom are retail. We're not going retail tonight. There's a 15% discount, so if anyone is interested, and if we run out of books, we'll just sign up. I'll bring the books in and get them to you at the discount, of course. All right? So if that's how you would like to go, let's hear then about Mr. Edward Coles. Albemarle native, Edward Coles, the emancipator, and second governor of the state of Illinois. Well, we're going to jump ahead, and he was 58 years old when he wrote about the day that he freed his slaves, 25 years before, on April the 14th, 1819. He and a party of 17 slaves were on a pair of flatboats tied together, two horses and a wagon on one, and a little shed, and most of the people were on the other. The slaves were six adults and 11 children, and one was on the way. They were just west of Pittsburgh, and their destination was Edwardsville, Illinois. And they were floating down the Ohio River, and Mr. Coles speaks here. The morning after we left Pittsburgh, a mild, calm, and lovely April day, the sun shining bright, the heavens without a cloud, our boats floating gently down the beautiful Ohio, the verdant foliage of spring just budding out on its picturesque banks. All around presenting a scene both conducive to and in harmony with the finest feelings of our nature, was selected as one well suited to make known to my Negroes the glad tidings of their freedom. Being curious to see the effect of an instantaneous severing of the manacles of bondage and letting loose on the buoyant wings of liberty the long pent-up spirit of man, I called on the deck of the boats which were lashed together all the Negroes and made them a short address, in which I commenced by saying it was time for me to make known to them what I intended to do with them, and concluded my remarks by so expressing myself that by a turn of sentence, I proclaimed in the shortest and fullest manner possible that they were no longer slaves, but free. Free as I was, and were at liberty to proceed with me or to go ashore at their pleasure. The effect on them was electrical, still Cole speaking. They stared at me and at each other as if doubting the accuracy or reality of what they had heard. In breathless silence, they stood before me, unable to utter a word, but with countenances beaming. and expression which no words could convey, and which no language can now describe, as they began to see the truth of what they had heard and to realize their situation, there came on a kind of hysterical, giggling laugh. And after a pause of intense and unutterable emotion, bathed in tears and with tremulous voices. So Edward Coles was determined at an early age, that is to say, in 1806, when he was 20 years old, that he would neither own slaves nor live in a country that accommodated slavery. He was certainly not the only Virginian to free slaves. There were, of course, other manumissions in Virginia. There was John Randolph of Roanoke, who freed more than 350 slaves by his will. And there was John Payne, the father of Dolly Madison, one of the earliest Quaker manumitters in Virginia. George Washington, of course, 124 slaves were freed by his will. And Samuel Gist, 350 slaves by his will. Robert Carter III freed more than 450 slaves over an extended period. So these are some of the most dramatic and grandiose gifts of freedom among Virginians. And yet our history books, for some reason, rarely points to them. As many as 10,000 slaves were freed in Virginia between 1782 and 1806, representing, true, only 2% of the slaves in Virginia, in the Commonwealth. So it wasn't unheard of, but it was certainly rare. And of course, it was controversial and a subversive thing to do. So one wonders, what set Edward Coles' heart and his intentions on the freeing of slaves and turning his back on his home state? Well, Edward Coles needed to free some slaves. He didn't do it to win salvation. He didn't do it to save money. He did it to save the Republic. Edward Coles was born on the 15th of December in 1786 at Enniscorthy, a plantation located not far from Scottsville, right here in Albemarle County. His father's plantation was a successful, diversified farming operation. Edward was the youngest male in a family of 10 surviving children, a big Virginia family that farmed and grew wealthy when the alliance of land, tobacco, and slaves dominated Virginia's economy. Edward started his schooling with tutors at home, but in due course, he went to Hampton, Sydney for one semester and then transferred to the College of William and Mary in Williamsburg and fell under the influence of its president, a man little known today, but well known to Coles' family, and he was the first bishop of the Episcopal Church of Virginia, the Reverend James Madison. So you recognize the name, of course. It happens that he was also the second cousin to the future president of the same name. Madison was, in addition, not only one of the leading clerics and scientists of his day, but also a leading exponent of Enlightenment theories of government based on individual rights. He advocated for government as a republic. And in keeping with this, he's said to have preached against speaking of the kingdom of heaven, for surely heaven is a republic. Freedom and self-governance, he taught to Coles and others, was the road to the highest state of human happiness and collective justice. Madison's views took hold in Edward Coles. An ember was ignited in him that would burn the rest of his life. And that ember was this: if Madison was right, then how could one justify slavery? Madison had no satisfactory answer for the young Mr. Coles, who discussed these matters privately with Madison over many months in 1806 and 1807. Rashly, Coles made a compact with himself at the age of 21. He would not own slaves, and he would not live in a place that accepted slavery. John Coles II, Edward's father, died in the winter of 1808. And by his will, Edward Coles received a plantation of 782 acres, the Rockfish Plantation, located in what is now Nelson County, Virginia, plus a dozen slaves and a debt of $500. He received slaves because he had kept his views about slavery to himself. Had he but mentioned to his father at an early point his views, Coles believed that his father would have swapped the slaves for property rather than give an unwanted gift. But Coles intentionally kept his views to himself. According to a memoir in his own hand written some years later, entirely to ensure that he would receive slaves, allowing him therefore to take a moral and political stand. And as we've seen, there were others who freed their slaves in Virginia, but I know of not one that took this kind of care to make a specific moral statement about slavery. Now, Cole's brother Isaac had been employed as the secretary to family friend and neighbor Thomas Jefferson during a portion of his presidency. So with the election of James Madison in 1809, prospects for Isaac's continuation in that role with the new administration were pretty strong. But an altercation at the U.S. Capitol with Maryland Representative Roger Nelson in 1810 became a political embarrassment to the new administration, and so Isaac left his post as a result. And James Madison asked Isaac to invite his brother Edward to join the White House, which he did before the end of January 1810. Now, during his 6 years in the White House, 1810 to 1815, Coles managed a large share of presidential correspondence. He handled patronage, he provided political intelligence, and he undertook special projects. During the same period, that is to say, well, we're talking about 1814 now, he wrote to Thomas Jefferson, pressing him to lead a public movement toward emancipation. Jefferson's elaborate rejection of Cole's plea highlights the contradictions that inhabit Jefferson's stances on slavery, race, and human rights. My own view is that this relatively famous interchange, this disappointing and surprising rejection by Mr. Jefferson, probably added steel to Cole's resolve to take action on the freeing of his own slaves. Through all of this, he was a slave master and a plantation owner, unsure really how he was going to separate himself from the holding of slaves. During 1815 through 1818, Coles made two trips to the Northwest Territories. Now we call that place Kentucky, Indiana, and Illinois. And a diplomatic mission he took to Russia at the request of President Madison. He had placed his Rockfish plantation for sale in 1810, but failed to find a buyer until 1817, when his eldest brother, Walter Coles, purchased the plantation, providing Edward with the funds allowing him to make concrete plans for his manumission project. So in the spring of 1819, Coles gathered his now 19 slaves at his Rockfish plantation and invited them to join his proposed move to Illinois. Under a commitment he had made to his family, the slaves were not told of his intention to free them. The family feared that knowledge of Edward's plan would spread an unhealthy virus of hope to the other family slaves. All the slaves agreed to the move, with the exception of two elderly women who had husbands that were owned by other members of the Coles family and whose circumstances made a move completely impractical. Coles also purchased the remainder of an indenture of one man in order to keep a family together in the face of the planned move to Illinois. Coles owned the wife and her five children, and he purchased the indenture of the father. So at this point, perhaps it's becoming clearer what it means to manumit slaves responsibly. The first thing is to recognize is that by law that came into force in January of 1806, all free slaves had to leave the state or risk being sold back into slavery. For the slave owner who wants to free slaves, then, the impact of this is monumental. Now you have to add the sacrifice of the value of the slaves, which you're giving up, to the cost of transporting that slave to some location that would accept them. The problem is multiplied for those with family, wives, husbands, and children on neighboring plantations owned by other slaveholders. So you have a choice to make. Purchase freedom for the entire family so that they may leave the state together. If so, the cost for in most cases would be utterly impossible to bear. If not, families are torn apart as some members are sent out of state while others must remain in bondage. And what justice is this? So consider the situation of slaves too young or too old or too infirm to move to some distant land. Once freed, consider the difficulty they would have in providing for themselves without the familiar support of the plantation system. For the elderly, a lifetime of service is rewarded with in declining years with abject poverty. And what justice is this? Giving a just freedom was more than setting a signature to a document. Coles managed these and other problems in devising a plan to free his slaves. He purchased the indenture of the husband of a family slave. He provided for the care of two elderly women who could not be separated from their ailing and elderly husbands. And he surveyed different distant lands to find a suitable place for settlement. Edward Coles, 16 slaves and one indentured servant, in total 6 adults and 11 children, left the Rockfish Plantation outfitted with papers, a wagon, horses, and various provisions and money on Thursday, the 1st of April, 1819, and Coles left separately. He caught up with his party in Brownsville, Pennsylvania, where he purchased 2 flatboats for the journey down the Monongahela to the Ohio rivers, and we've already been on the flatboats with them and been a party to the dramatic scene of their emancipation on the Ohio. Edward Coles was the register of lands in Edwardsville, Illinois for 2 years. He purchased and conveyed 3 parcels of 120 acres each to 3 families of those he freed. And then, in 1822, he ran for governor and won by the slimmest of margins. His inaugural address focused on internal improvements, farming, and education, but also called for an end to slavery in the state, a persistent, if shadowy, institution in Illinois. In reaction to this abrupt proposal, a pro-slavery faction in Illinois, in the Illinois legislature, called for a constitutional convention, the unstated purpose of which was to fully legalize slavery. Through twisted and entirely improper procedures, the pro-slavery faction managed to force a bill through the legislature calling for a referendum to authorize a constitutional convention. During the next 18 months, Illinois was caught up in a passionate, divisive, and even violent political struggle. To defeat the call for the convention, Edward Coles contributed the entirety of his income as governor. He purchased a newspaper to promote the anti-slavery cause, and he led the elaborate organization of county-level committees to oppose the pro-slavery effort. Among the tactics adopted by the pro-convention faction was a civil suit that was brought against Coles that spuriously accused him of freeing his slaves without posting a necessary bond in the state. Coles was vindicated by the Supreme Court of Illinois in the spring of 1826. The call for a constitutional convention was defeated in the election of 1824 due both to opposition from Illinois churches and to the leadership of Governor Coles. Coles' term as governor ended in 1826, and the Constitution of Illinois precluded a second term. Well, he ran for the U.S. Senate in 1831, but was defeated. So Coles decided to leave Illinois for Philadelphia. where finally, fairly late in life, he married Sally Logan Roberts and raised a family. Also at the time, he corresponded with Thomas Jefferson's grandson, Thomas Jefferson Randolph, successfully encouraging him to oppose slavery during the 1831 slavery debate in the Virginia legislature. Coles also conferred with the aging James Madison on a plan to emancipate Madison's slaves by his will. In fact, it is solely through the letters of Edward Coles that we can come to any kind of understanding as to why James Madison did not free his slaves. During Christmas of 1831, James Madison declared to Edward Coles that he wished to free his slaves in his will, and the two men discussed the matter at length. But in the end, as we know, James Madison freed not a one of them. No freedom was granted, no bondage renounced, not a soul freed, not even one. Coles smoldered over Madison's failure to free his slaves, and equally over Dolly Madison's sale of slaves in 1836 in a manner that appears to violate the specific terms of Madison's will, but may also point to a contempt for the morality of manumission. That's speculation, but it's there to be considered. Coles presents us with evidence, not conclusive evidence, but real evidence, that Madison may have left written instructions to Dolly to free the family slaves by her will. So you must decide yourself if Dolly Madison is in any way culpable for her failure to free any slaves. It's an intriguing question for which there's no final answer, but reasonable people looking back in sympathy could come to very different conclusions about this favorite daughter of Virginia. During his declining years in Philadelphia, Edward Coles became known as one of the few remaining people with direct personal connections to the founding fathers. He provided advice and anecdotes to biographers, burnishing the reputations of Madison and Jefferson as champions of freedom, and he specifically defended Jefferson as the author of the Northwest Ordinance of 1787, through a publication of a monograph on the subject. And Edward Coles died on the 7th of July, 1868. And what of the slaves that he freed? What of the slaves that he freed? What happened? Recall that the party of slaves freed by Coles was 17 in number, 6 adults and 11 children. The oldest was Ralph Crawford. He died of yellow fever in 1819, just after he was freed. It's said by Coles that of the two gifts that Coles made, freedom and land, it was the land, having his own farm. That's what animated Ralph. But he didn't live long enough to acquire that land. His wife, Kate, came into the property that her husband had been promised by Mr. Coles, and over a long life, built for herself a comfortable existence in Illinois. She ended up marrying Ralph's brother, Robert Crawford, many years later. More about him in a minute. Polly Crawford, the young sister of Robert and Ralph, grew up and married Michael Lee, a local freed black, in 1822. The children of Ralph and Kate grew up, married free blacks in the Edwardsville region, and moved to various places in Illinois, especially Decatur. Thomas Cobb fell down a public well and died. We don't know what happened to Nancy Gaines, but she also died sometime after her manumission was recorded in July of 1819. And recall the servant whose indenture Coles had purchased in 1819? Manuel was his name, and his wife was Suki. They had 6 children. The one who was born just after the arrival in Illinois in 1819 died on the farm of Mr. Stephen Hampstead, Sr., just outside of St. Louis, during the summer of their arrival. The family lived in a house on land owned by Mr. Coles in St. Louis, until at least 1854. And Manuel did pay back the indenture cost to Edward Coles. And Robert Crawford, who I mentioned before, he became the proof that Coles was searching for, that manumission could be positive and productive. Robert Crawford became a well-known preacher in the Edwardsville area, helping to nurture the growth of two or three parishes and participating in the development of a regional coalition of churches, the Colored Baptist Association and Friends to Humanity, which was to become transformed and renamed in time to the Wood River Baptist District Association, which is now the oldest surviving, currently operational Black Baptist organization in America, and an early element lending support and organizational strength to the development of the NAACP. So what was the significance of Edward Coles? His efforts to end slavery set that state on a slow transition toward greater racial freedom. His contribution was in standing firmly against the tide of slavery in Illinois, and his leadership was clearly decisive in this. Frank O. Loudon, who was the governor of Illinois in 1917 to 1921, introduced the reissue of the first published biography of Edward Coles with a personal assessment of the significance of Coles' life. Had Coles not stopped a nefarious effort to put slavery into the Illinois Constitution, Loudon believed Illinois would have become a slave state. The great debates between Lincoln and Douglas would not have occurred. Lincoln would not have become president. Indeed, and I'm quoting here directly, indeed, with Illinois a slave state, Loudon went on, it's entirely possible that the Confederacy might have won. So here we have Edward Coles as the driver of the outcome of the Civil War. Yeah. I think this is hyperbole. For me, the significance of Edward Coles and his stand for freedom is in the demonstration of the enduring truth of one Republican belief, and that is that justice is not the exclusive product of great men of history. It's very often the product of great citizens. Thank you. I have a question from the back.
Bruce, tell us what happened to Roberts.
Roberts Coles. The question is, what happened to Roberts Coles? Roberts Coles was the youngest son of Edward Coles. He had three children. Roberts was special because he related to the life and the charm of Albemarle County, and who can blame him, right? He really related to it, considered himself a Virginian. He grew up in Philadelphia, of course, and his school friends apparently made fun of him. That he referred to himself constantly as a Virginian, not as a Pennsylvanian. He spent most of his summers in Virginia on the Green Mountain at his uncle's plantations. And so it got into his bones, and when he became 21, he decided he would leave home, and he came down to Virginia and started to build a plantation with help from the family that, of course, was very glad to see him because he was kind of turning his back on his father's approach to everything. So this is 1861. He was in the state, moving along in his new life for 1 year when the Civil War broke out. And he decided that he had to make a stand for what he believed in, so he joined the Confederacy, the Green Mountain Grays, and became captain of the Green Mountain Grays. And they ultimately ended up in West Virginia and then hiked around, and you know they never had any battles exactly, but they ended up over at Nag's Head with the intention of protecting the Roanoke Island, which was very soon to be under the guns of General Burnside, who was bringing up a large number of ships and hoped to make his way to Richmond by going up through Albemarle Sound. So Roberts Coles is a captain of the Green Mountain Grays, and they're on the way across the Albemarle Sound to get to the island so that they can defend it. There's already, of course, a lot of Confederate soldiers there, but they're in support. So he writes a little letter to a woman that he has become betrothed to, Jeannie Fairfax, who is the daughter of a wealthy business person in Richmond. It's a very, very touching note in which he tells her of his love, says that that I do all of this for you, if we meet again someday, wouldn't it be lovely? And he closes by saying, I must sign off now because the shells fly thick. Roberts Coles took a bullet in the breast. It was discovered by a New York journalist. So the entire story of his passing away in the most tragic circumstances, in defending the life that his father had turned his back on, adds a poignant turnabout to the whole story. And that is covered in a chapter of the book. What do you think? Could this be a movie? Yeah. We were talking about this before. Yes, JJ.
Yeah, well, I'm from Decatur, Illinois, so tell me more about this person that moved there. Did continue in farming or get into
the... No, the family that moved to Decatur became very wealthy as rag pickers. He basically did very well in the trade of collecting junk and selling it, and I don't know what else. His name was Michael Lee, and there's not very much known about him, and there's a little bit more in the book, but not much. Yeah, you're welcome. Yes?
Does the fact that Illinois toys with the idea of becoming a slave state, does that vindicate Jefferson, who is not diametrically opposed to manumission, but who believes that the hate and prejudice in the country is so great that free blacks cannot survive, and therefore, when manumission occurs, they have to go back to Africa? I'm going to go back, make sure you got it. Does what happened in Illinois vindicate Jefferson, who believes that the hatred and prejudice is so great that they cannot survive in America if, in fact, they are manumitted and stay there?
Not to me, it doesn't. But I don't want to leave it right there. It is so hard for us to make judgments on this particular question. We stand on this side of the Civil War. We know what it took to bring emancipation. And we think that to people who were living in those days, the fact that African Americans and white Americans could live together in some measure of harmony is obvious to us. But was it so obvious to most people in those days? Now that we're on this side, as I say, of the Civil War, I think it's a tall order to try and set that question some sense of completion and get a sense of satisfaction from it. It's very difficult. It's a long journey to take that to answer that particular question. But I feel also comfortable about saying that it does not vindicate Jefferson for me.
But Jefferson is prepared to see an amalgamation with Indians and whites. But he believes that hatred and prejudice with blacks is too great for an amalgamation to occur.
Lest we be too hard on Mr. Jefferson, the approach that Jefferson proposed, it was called a post-Natty Emancipation Plan. I won't go into the details, but it has to do with essentially taking a date certain after which those who are born into slavery would be freed by the age of 15 or 20, depending upon which plan you're talking about. And those who were born before that period would not. Those who were born after the period would have to work off the value of their own value, essentially purchasing their freedom, and then they would have to leave. It's not negotiable. It's not, you know, it's not like we're doing this because we want them to have some sort of control over their lives. This is the plan. You do it, whether you like it or not. You're going to Africa. There's no choice in the matter. This was the plan proposed by Thomas Jefferson. It was the plan proposed by James Madison. It was the plan proposed by Edward Coles. Okay? All three of them proposed the same plan, essentially, with very, very small differences. So while Edward Coles appears to be someone who has gone well beyond questions of slavery, he has not gone beyond in questions of race. Okay? Yes, please.
I think I misunderstood along the way. I thought that Edward Coles put together a community of these people, but he didn't. He spread them out in different areas?
No. Well, it's sort of halfway between. He purchased five pieces of property. One was the main property of his own plantation called the Prairie Land Farm. And then there was a little group of some small acreage that he also... Then there were three more pieces of properties, and they were 120 acres, but they were separated by, oh, I want to say 4 or 5 miles for each one. So it was in no sense a community. However, when they moved to Illinois, these were just rough lands, and as far as I know, none of the slaves ever built anything on any of those pieces of land. They didn't farm that land. They farmed Coles land, and he paid them to do it. Right, they were very grateful to him for this. They wanted to work for him. They were grateful for what he had done. They wanted to see him make a success. And he, of course, was their security. So they worked for him, for the most part, on his land. So in that sense, it was a kind of a community. Part of the community split off and went to St. Louis, as I mentioned. So I think we have some families that are dependent on Mr. Coles, but I don't know whether that defines a community or not. Maybe it does. And I think, Rick, you had a question.
Yeah, I think it's kind of a follow-up on what Walt was saying. I agree with you. I don't think it vindicates Mr. Jefferson. I think the great big takeaway is how many Southerners were in Illinois.
After
all, they had followed the Ohio River.
That's true.
You know, and so, but another thing that I find really interesting, can you tell me if this has occurred to you, the connection between Virginia and Illinois, you also have a connection between Jefferson and Lincoln. Lincoln, the great student of Jefferson's writings, also did not believe that the two races could live together peaceably in the United States.
Yeah, that's all.
Another connection between Illinois and Virginia.
Exactly right. We're still struggling with how these things fit together. And to the extent that we have enlightenment, it's very recent.
Right.
Yes.
You said that Coles opposed the idea of a constitutional convention. Was he that certain that a constitutional convention would lead to a slave state?
He was not inexperienced in the politics of Illinois. He had, in fact, I mentioned that he took two trips to Illinois in looking for land. One of them was in 1818, and he went to Kaskaskia, which was the site of the constitutional convention when Illinois was the state was formed. So he had some years of experience in observing Illinois politics. And he was not the only one who knew that this was a subterfuge. It was very clear what was going on to those who were close enough to be able to hear and see. So my judgment is that it was a sound judgment. There was one journalist who was writing at the time who thought that what he had done was very foolish and precipitous. That by bringing this up in such a clear and bald way, what he had done was forced an alliance among those who were pro-slavery. There's a great the history of slavery in Illinois is very interesting because we think of Illinois as one of the Northwest Territories, and so therefore by the Northwest Ordinance of 1787, well, there is no slave. Wow, that's not so. There were slaves in Illinois right from the beginning, not right from the beginning, but after the French came in, bringing slaves, and then when Illinois was transferred from the French to the English, did the property convey as well? Of course it did. No matter what it might say about the slaves, property was conferred, right? And when Illinois was transferred from Illinois to Virginia, Was property transferred? Yes, it was. So those who lived in Illinois and had what they referred to as French slaves, they were on solid legal ground because at each step of the way, the property was conveyed. And so they believed that it was perfectly legal to hold slaves in Illinois, notwithstanding what Mr. Edward Coles or Mr. Thomas Jefferson or anyone else from the East might think. They interpreted it as, well, you can't bring new slaves in. That's the way they argued it. And so it was really, they wanted to place a certain number of people, especially those involved with the salt business in Illinois, not tobacco, but salt, wanted to preserve their ability to hire, to have people work for very little, because salt was profitable, but only if you got it with very little expenditure for all the manpower. It hasn't changed a whole lot. Any other question? Yes, sir.
1806 law, which made it so difficult.
Yeah.
For free slaves, it was passed by the legislature deliberately to kind of suppress any expansion of that freeing of slaves.
Yes. There are a number of ways of looking at it. The law had been opened up to manumission in 1782. And so that gives those who own property in slaves the freedom to do with their property as they wish. Okay? That's right. So in 1806, that what they're doing in part is protecting the value of slaves. They're also avoiding the cost of having to live among these people once they are freed, if they are freed. But they didn't say you couldn't free them. So they're protecting the rights of the property owner to do with your property as you see fit. But they're also protecting the rights of the other white citizens not to have to live with them. So you've got competing rights. What's the balance? And the legislature decided that this was the way to do it. And what it did, of course, was put a break on manumission in Virginia. Not entirely, but to a meaningful degree.
Well, didn't part of it also depend on the number of African Americans that already were here, the percentage of blacks who might be scary to have next to everybody?
That may be so. Once again, that's a question, and the question is whether the number of African Americans in Virginia that would have raised anxieties about having blacks about, maybe so. It's once again, hard to put oneself in that time. You have to get a kind of a sense of how the slaves were distributed among the population and how often you'd come across them and what that all felt like and, you know, what it was like to go to church, and, you know, lots of sort of daily routine things that you'd have to understand, which I don't. So.
But the crops made a huge difference. What people were growing, the crops were heavily slave dependent. The McCormick of Virginia and the reapers made wheat not so expensive. So guess what they did? For the first time, they really broke families up and sent them to the cotton and rice, South Carolina.
Well, that's certainly true. There's an entire a fascinating history, economic story about Virginia and the decline of the Commonwealth in many different dimensions, not just in agriculture, but in a lot of other ways as well, right at about this time. And it catches up with the likes of James Madison and Thomas Jefferson in ways that were very, very painful for their families, and caused a great deal of hardship among the slaves who had to be sold off in order to make back some of the debt, you know. So that's a story that's part of a very much larger economic story related to the decline of Virginia in the 1800s. How are we doing for time? We good? Okay.
Wasn't there an all-pervasive fear of slave uprisings? So, I mean, a lot of the legislature, a lot of the thinking was we must protect ourselves.
Well, there were more slave uprisings than you might imagine. We know of some famous ones, but there were, you know, I would say, and I in the book I cite a number, and I think it's in the neighborhood of a couple dozen that it happened over a 30 or 40 year period. 1831, of course, is the those concerns become, they boil over. Reasonable or not reasonable, they boil over, and that is the this is Nat Turner Rebellion, and then following that, only a matter of months later, is the only time that the question of slavery in Virginia came up in the legislature, and that's another great story that Coles had some influence over. From a distance in Philadelphia, by way of his ability to convince Thomas Jefferson Randolph to stand up and speak the words that his grandfather would have spoken, and that those words that Randolph well timed in that plunged the legislature into the substantive discussion which they had been reluctant to get into for a couple of weeks during the legislature. So Cole's influence is surprisingly pervasive during his lifetime, notwithstanding the fact that his views on race remain very awkward, and I think we would not find much approval in those.
Was he influenced by Wilberforce?
Not that I'm aware of. He was influenced by the Reverend James Madison. And I invite you to look into him, Google him. You'll find that he was widely published. He was inducted into the Philosophical Society the same year as Jefferson.
Why did you choose this gentleman to research?
You know, it was strange. My wife is a native of Charlottesville, so she's got all kinds of picture books about old Charlottesville and stuff. And one on our bookshelf that I picked up some. Oh, it was 10 years after we got married, and I just never looked at it, you know. And it had nothing more than a photograph of a painting of Edward Coles and a little paragraph. And it said, "This man freed his slaves," and he was an Albemarle native. And I what do you mean he freed his slaves? What in the world are you talking about? I had no notion at all that manumission was something that was done in those days. My immediate reaction was, "Well, this doesn't look good for Jefferson."
Yeah.
Right? Right? If this man could do it. So, I was curious. So I went to the Jefferson Madison Regional Library, and I found that they actually had a genealogical book on the Coles family, and so that was a starting point. You know how you pull the thread on this sweater, and then you'll find that there is, you know, and I came across a great article not too long after starting it by an obscure historian by the name of Rick Britton. Rick has published on this very story, and Rick's article was not the very first, but among the first that I read, there are others out there, but I just got in further and further. And I remember also, after about 2 years of just, you know, I was doing this as a hobby. It was just sort of fun. I had a box of maybe, 15, 20, 30 papers, and I thought, man, this is all there is. You have the whole thing. You got it all, right? Well, it's 10 years later, and I have three boxes full. Among them, you know, all the collection from Princeton, and there's a lot out there. It's a great story, and it was fun to work on. Thank you.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.